Welcome to the Just for Kicks podcast. I'm Joey, he's Steve, and today we've got rapid reactions to Roma's heartbreaking loss in the Europa League final to Sevilla, a dramatic final day in the German Bundesliga as Dortmund fell painfully close to breaking Bayern's streak atop the league. It would have been a decade of history ended, but nope, just number 11. You can thank Bambi for that. Oh, what did I forget? Oh yeah, it's Manchester Derby time with it all on the line in the English FA Cup. All that, plus more EPL content than you can ever ask for on this edition of the Just for Kicks podcast. So, Steve, I got this question for you. More shocking, this season of Succession or Todd Boehly's first season as owner of Chelsea?
What is the opposite of an unassisted triple play?
Probably spending $500 million and forgetting a proven goal scorer. Let's start the show. Welcome back to Just for Kicks podcast. We have so much to get to, so much to recap, so much to reflect on. What in the last week is the best thing you saw, Steve? What really warmed your heart to the beautiful game?
You know I want to say the Granit Xhaka double on his send-off, scoring two goals pretty much right off the bat for Arsenal in their final game of the season, just positive vibes everywhere before he likely leaves for the Bundesliga, but it's got to be Doucouré's goal for Everton, keeping them up, like,
ooh,
so emphatic, such scenes, nothing like relegation Sunday, and he saved Everton once again.
What did I text you right after it happened? I think I said something like, if his shirt was 5% more baggy, this reminded me of vintage Fox soccer highlights.
Yeah, it was amazing. Like,
and he had a half a century of history on the line, man. If Everton had gone down, I mean, every storyline we'd be reading would be about just kind of the end of that era of Premier League glory. And Doucouré, with that strike, he saved them, man. He saved them. But we'll dive more into the relegation race. But the first thing I have to do, which is, it's a moral obligation at this point, because I've never, even looking back at that Bayern Munich Manchester United Champions League final where United snuck two goals past them, you know, in the 11th hour, and the players were just laying on the field. These Dortmund guys, I've never seen anybody lay on the field for that long. Like, the referees were trying to pick them up. Their own coaches were trying to pick them up. I've never seen such visceral heartbreak. They were going in minus 750 to beat Mainz to win German Bundesliga for the first time in 10 years. They'd come in second, six out of the last 10 years. And it looked like, despite a completely limp performance, Bayern was going to choke it away and hand it to him until Jamal Musiala, the artist we affectionately call Bambi, had just an amazing strike, amazing awareness.
Yep, that was a great goal.
Yeah. How do you emotionally recover from that as a competitor? I mean, are you just staring into the abyss of your competitive soul? I mean, man. I would say there are no words, but Steve, you want to pour one out for our poor fallen comrades?
Typically, I want to be really neutral in these situations, but after Bayern's decade of dominance, I didn't feel bad rooting for the underdog here, Dortmund is the underdog going into the season. They were very much the favorite going into the final day. And then all they had to do was win, and then it wouldn't have mattered what Bayern Munich's outcome was. But if Bayern Munich were to draw, they would also win the league. So it was all kind of in flux. Right off the bat, they look kind of listless and can't quite break through. Bayern gets a goal in the eighth minute. Word starts to spread around Germany, the buzz hits, and then completely against the run of play, Mainz gets a goal against Dortmund. They get another. Suddenly, they have a huge hill to climb. Sebastian Haller misses a penalty for Dortmund, and just everything feels completely lost. You're talking about how to recover from the outcome, but like at that point, it felt like something you would not want to be a part of.
No.
Second half, Bayern Munich gives up another goal. suddenly Dortmund is in control of the situation again, and then Musiala happens, and they never quite recover. And the scenes at Signal Iduna Park after the fact were absolutely brutal. Yeah, 11 straight victories or titles in a row for Bayern Munich. Looked like this was going to go the other way, finally. But something about that German championship is inevitable. It'll be hard for them to pick themselves back up, I'm sure. But fortunately, they've got a couple months to do it. That was one of the toughest final days to watch I've ever seen.
Yeah. I thought, in spite of just how ill-equipped they were to handle the situation, you know, Sané had a late breakaway that he could not lift over the keeper. And at that point in time, I think they're about 88 minutes into the match. And I was like, they're gonna pull this out despite doing absolutely nothing to help their case. But sure enough, we all saw why people see what they see in Jamal Musiala. I mean, the strike was insane, but the field awareness, the dribbling, setting himself up, I mean, he really just kind of pulled this out of a hat in a way that shifted the entire Bundesliga. And how old is he? Like 20?
I think he's maybe barely over 20. Yeah, and, you know, it kind of sticks to the mentality of both of these teams, and the story of both of these teams is mia san mia for Bayern Munich. They're always going to go for the win. They had to have it, and they got it at the death, whereas Dortmund basically just had to hold serve and couldn't pull that off. So the narrative continues. Dortmund's been improving for several seasons. Bayern's been getting worse point totals for several seasons now. And Leipzig even is coming up a little bit behind. I'm hoping there's another dramatic finish in the Bundesliga next season. But it is kind of hard to speculate that if the teams aren't willing to take these kind of chances against Bayern Munich, at what point will their opportunity kind of fall through their fingers?
Yeah. Well, at the beginning of this season, you know, you did the math. You talked about the goals that Bayern was losing via Lewandowski. They're obviously brought in some other people. Choupo-Moting was, you know, more than capable. But you did, you know, really outline how many, many teams in the Bundesliga could creep up if a couple things broke a certain way. They did. And Bayern was just so, so lucky to escape. Can you reflect on just where Bayern goes from here? I mean, are they just kind of laughing all the way to the bank and just saying, well, that was never in doubt? Or is this really, really going to be more hand-wringing this offseason, more Ole Gunnar making sure that Thomas Tuchel is implementing the correct system? I mean, are they taking the shackles off from one of the most accomplished managers ever? Or is this still a work in progress?
There's definitely some improvement to be made. Again, I think this is the lowest point total they've had during this 11-season run. They were replacing Robert Lewandowski, who is one of the best goal scorers we've ever seen, set the record for Bundesliga goals in a season. And, you know, they were able to survive. They fired Oliver Kahn, their CEO, and another board member immediately after this game. So they certainly see the writing on the wall. And with the resources they have, it's hard to imagine them sitting pat for very long. Adding the fact they have Thomas Tuchel, it's going to require another leap from Dortmund to catch them, probably Leipzig as well. And Bayern's not going to take kindly to what they'll probably see as some level of failure despite winning it. They have bigger aspirations than barely squeaking by on the final day. So I certainly expect them to improve on this project, and it was kind of a down year in a lot of categories, so I don't think that Dortmund will find themselves in such a favorable position.
No. And if the board of directors at Bayern Munich want to leave any ambiguity as to how they feel about the decision that was recommended to them strongly to get rid of Julian Nagelsmann in the middle of the season, I think Oliver Kahn's dismissal now makes it abundantly clear they think hindsight's 2020. But let's move on to more European heartbreak, because we're recording this on a Wednesday, and we just got done watching the Europa League final. And there's so much on the line. Sevilla against Roma, winner advances to the Champions League, wins the Europa League. It was an odd match, to say the very least. But in the end, it went down to penalties, and it was just a heartbreaking result for Roma. I thought Roma was a better team on the day. I thought they took it to Sevilla. Sevilla's only goal came from an own goal from Roma's center half, Mancini, who also tragically missed a penalty in the penalty shootout at the end of the match.
Yeah, he had a wild day.
He had a wild day. And, you know, to his credit, it was a difficult kick save, but probably should have put a little more elevation on the ball. But, you know, could have, should have, would have. A lot of people missed the entire frame. We've seen Harry Kane do it. But, you know, I think Mourinho is going to get a lot of flack, and we're already seeing it for who ended up taking the penalties at the very end, because it was largely defenders. But he still had forwards and midfielders who were known for how to place the ball and take penalties on the field at the time. Every manager has different methodologies, different routines, you know, describes different ways of thinking when it comes to penalties. Can you lay this loss on Mourinho, or did he just not put them in the best position? Or penalties are a coin flip, man.
Penalties are definitely a coin flip, but general consensus is that defenders are not your best option at getting a ball into the net. I would say even more so when you're picking your defenders who have just played 130 minutes, where you have strikers on the field who have played 30 tops. There are several options of attacking players who had been on the field for half an hour.
Correct.
And in addition to the fact they got their early goal through Dybala, and they kind of tried to shut up shop. Dybala and Abraham were two of his earlier subs, and he kind of put himself in a position to have to make these kind of decisions. And ultimately, I think he was a little bit conservative. I know that he has full faith in his players and his system and whatnot to pull through in these kind of scenarios. Surely he's done it more than most, and especially myself. But yeah, I think he kind of painted himself into a corner and ultimately paid the price for it. But you know, he knows more than I do, so I would imagine he can defend it.
Yeah, I would imagine he can too. It's just, you know, on balance, it's kind of like Diet Real Madrid when it comes to Sevilla and the Europa League. Like, we just, if anything is left up to fate, luck, or chance, it seems like Sevilla is going to bag it. And today, I think Roma beat themselves. I mean, not to say that Sevilla was awful, but they just weren't nearly as dangerous as Roma when Roma was actually going for it. You think the special one took his foot off the gas too soon? You think he could have closed him out earlier?
Yeah, I think Roma kind of sat in, and they took – Sevilla wasn't able to really play through them, but they were able to just launch balls in over and over, and you let that happen enough times, something bad's going to happen to you. Chris Smalling had an outstanding game, and I think Mourinho was leaning on him a lot to just clear the air, but eventually something bad's going to happen when you're out there for that long trying to defend like that, and it did. And again, game got all the way to penalties, and you're really pushing your luck there. You did mention, though, that this is Sevilla in a European or Europa League final. And for all of Mourinho's well-documented success in these events, Sevilla is now 7-for-7 in the last 17 years in Europa League finals. This is their competition, and no one holds a candle to them. In fact, Spain has not lost to a non-Spanish team in a European final since 2001.
Wow.
They're 22 titles and 43 opportunities.
Wow.
Yeah.
That, my friend, is staggering.
Also, shout out to Mourinho's counterpart, Mendelbar. He took over midseason. I can't remember exactly when, but the Sevilla team was in 19th place in La Liga. On January 14th, he's only had two losses out of their last 16 games or something of the sort. They've gotten through Juventus and Man United to get here. So full credit to them. You made a couple of switches at halftime that really paid off, and they were able to, you know, finally poke their way through. So very deserving performance.
Two losses. When you're in 19th place and only have two losses for the remainder of the season. Because, I mean, you have to crawl out of it. So, you know.
Oh, it wasn't quite the rest of the season. There was another little gap in there, but it was a long, hard climb, to say the very least. And now they're in the Champions League.
It's just unbelievable. It's just unbelievable. The money that was on the line because of those spot kicks, the trajectory of those teams. It's really, really wild. And like we said last week, Mourinho really put all his eggs in the Europa League basket. And he almost cashed it, but it just did not work out. Well, moving along from the Europa League, this was the final week of the Premier League season. And although City had already wrapped up the title, the top four was already confirmed to be United, Newcastle, Arsenal, and Manchester City. All the action, as you pointed out, was for those relegation spots. That Everton managed to stay up, joining them going down, Leicester and Southampton. It's always amazing how at the end of the year, this is really what kind of binds us all when there isn't anything going on at the top of the table. And the ramifications are just massive, regardless of the history of these sides. This was very, very, very close. Going into the last weekend, Leeds could have stayed up. Leicester could have stayed up. Everton had half of a century on the line. But ultimately, it was Leicester and it was Leeds that went down. Let's just reflect on the seasons that... let's start with Leeds, because there was so much hope. And there was this feel-good story of this young American nucleus coming to play for Jesse Marsh that lasted, I don't know, 3 seconds?
Yeah, give or take.
What was Leeds' terminal illness? What doomed them in a way that not even Big Sam could save these guys?
The defense. They gave up the most goals in the league, so that should typically get you relegated.
Well, you know what they say. Defense wins championships.
It also gets you relegated whenever it's the other way around.
And then Leicester, and you know, we'll talk more during our upcoming segment where we do our EPL superlatives and not so superlatives. But you know, this is the end of an era of the last team is not a traditional big six side to win the league. And it's just, it's funky. I think I texted you right after the match. King Power Stadium is now a championship side. Like, it's just, it's going to be weird without Leicester around next year. Probably not as weird as it would have been without Everton, without having a Merseyside derby. But let's take stock of what Leicester has accomplished during this stint in the Premier League. And really, kind of sticking a craw in anybody who ever says that this league is a league that is dominated and can only be bossed by a handful of sides. Because they proved with their amazing run, anybody can win this league. The right day, right combination, right nucleus of players, right coach, right system. They were the underdog's underdog. What are you going to remember about Leicester winning the title and this run in the Premier League?
Yeah, obviously their title was the high point. One of the most memorable seasons I'm sure I'll ever get to experience in the Premier League, and hugely romantic in the sense that it does give hope to these other clubs that maybe just maybe you catch lightning in the bottle once. I feel like it gets even more impressive when we get further away from it and the names on the trophy continue to stack up of the other big teams, and they're just shuffled in there. And it wasn't like the start of a new era. It was just this complete blip on the radar. But, you know, they were the best team that season, by all accounts. They had some outstanding talent that at that point was relatively unknown and really put it all together and deserve all the credit in the world. I think that was 2 seasons off of them getting promoted, maybe 3.
Yeah.
So that makes it even more impressive. After that, they go to a Champions League quarterfinal, fall short to Atletico Madrid, who at that point are one of the powers of the world, and subsequently win an FA Cup only 2 or 3 seasons ago. So it's been a wild ride.
It's been a wild ride.
They got promoted, staved off relegation by the skin of their teeth the next season, and then win a title, go to the Champions League, knockout stages, win an FA Cup, and then suddenly they're back in league or the second division.
They made it to the quarters, baby. Like, they did it. They fired their manager and then progressed.
Yeah. And, you know, nobody wants to get relegated, but I think that Leicester fans surely are appreciative of the time they've had and realize that maybe the luck would run out at some point. And I would say 95% of the teams in England, or at least in the England football divisions, would bite your hand off at the opportunity to have one of those 3 opportunities, title, Champions League, or FA Cup. So good on you, Leicester. Sorry it's not going to work out, but it's been one of the more fun teams to follow from a neutral perspective for the last decade almost.
Well, you know who would just absolutely kill to have a Premier League title in the last handful of years, and that's Manchester United. They can come pretty close and continue with their statement of intent if they manage to upset Manchester City in the FA Cup, which will be the first time the FA Cup is contested between City and Manchester United. You know, Ten Hag has a chance to do one over on his mentor, who so far has just basically had his way with him this season. But to Ten Hag's credit, Pep's kind of had his way with everybody this season. If you are a United fan right now, as long as this match ends in a respectable fashion where you don't get completely blown out, it seems a little pretentious to say that this season wasn't a success. Was it not?
I would even count the Carabao Cup.
Oh, yeah.
In the sense that if Man United wins a trophy this is back in August. If Man United wins a trophy this season, I would consider it a success. Now, we have entered a new reality where they have an opportunity to win a second trophy, win the cup double, something that would be far exceeding expectations, I believe. Meanwhile, preventing their rival from marching on to a potential treble. So at this point, it is less about it being considered a successful season and more starting to feel like an obligation and a necessity to prevent their neighbors from being able to one-up one of their most prestigious achievements of all time, the Sir Alex Ferguson treble. And they're one of the two things standing in the way of City really immortalizing themselves.
Is there, you know, I look at this match and I'm trying to figure out the million different ways that United could rationally win this. You know, last year Pep did have some opportunities to win some trophies in cup competitions. And I think we saw rotation and putting underwhelming sides on the field. Back then, underwhelming sides included names like Jack Grealish. That's not the case anymore.
Oh yeah, this underwhelming side is going to have Riyad Mahrez.
Yeah, this underwhelming side's going to have Riyad Mahrez and Phil Foden. But even so, I just think they're too big to fail. The system at this point, the way that they're playing, the way they operate, the fluidity, I don't see anyone slowing them down. Aside from maybe Inter Milan, who I think is uniquely equipped. But I can't really make a rational argument that Man United has any advantages in any way, shape, or form in this match. I mean, is that hyperbolic? Is that hysterical?
Manchester City are heavy favorites. My glimmer of light or hope for Man United is Man United was one of the last teams to take something from Manchester City. Granted, that was a very different Manchester City than what we're experiencing now. But whether it be through rotation or by rust of the fact that they've rotated the last couple of weeks, I'm wondering if Man United might just get a Man City that they can kind of jab, survive 45 minutes, and nick a goal. Unfortunately for them, Manchester City is 100% healthy, almost, and Manchester United is definitely down Martial, probably Antony. It's an uphill battle, that's for certain, but I do think that there's an opportunity here. We haven't seen Man City the last couple weeks with the same lineup that was just setting the world on fire previously for the last 3 months. They've rotated, gotten some people some rest, and I'm interested to see if they'll continue that rotation or if they put out that, you know, superstar 11, if they maybe have some rust together and provides an opportunity for Manchester United to take advantage. I get the creeping sense that something's going to happen either in this match being a cup final or the Champions League final, and this will be a theme of my Inter Milan hope next week. It's not going to be a walkover both weeks for Manchester City. I don't know if it'll be this week against Manchester United, but there's going to be a hiccup in here somewhere.
I think so too. When we come back on the Just for Kicks podcast, we have a very, very special guest to discuss just how heartbreaking today's Europa League final is for the Roma faithful. We have all that and more when we come back to you on the Just for Kicks podcast. Welcome back to the Just for Kicks podcast. We have a very, very special guest, somebody who is near and dear to both of our hearts. There are a lot of things I can say about the man we're about to introduce you to, but what you need to know for point of reference is he is a diehard Roma fan, and he's picking up pieces of his brain, heart, and soul off the floor because of what's transpired. And some news just broke that might make it a little worse. Are you ready, Chip? I'm sorry. I don't want to be the guy to do this to you.
Shit.
It appears Jose Mourinho has made a statement about his future with the club. The special one may need a break.
Good. That's perfect. That's just what I needed.
So after the match, Mourinho was just asked about his future with the club. He said he thinks the players deserve better and that he's tired of serving as manager, head of communications, and the face of the club. If Mourinho leaves, who's walking in that door that's better? Chip, how are you feeling right now?
That's a pretty easy answer, right? I mean, no one. With the talent that he had on that roster this year, now obviously league competition didn't do so hot, but with the talent he had on that roster and with the injuries that that team had all year, and even today, some of those dudes were basically walking zombies out there with the injuries they're still dealing with. What he accomplished, I don't see anybody else matching it.
Yeah. And Steve and I have talked ad nauseum about how this Juventus, you know, point deduction scandal has made it so hard for every team that's floating in and around the top four. You know, he had to make some pretty tough calculations about who he was fielding when on a decimated side to try to get back in the Champions League. And I think that this might, you know, them not being in the Champions League next year now, it's probably going to have a big bearing on why he's exhausted making the comments that he's making, is it not?
Oh, we're going backwards, right? We're in the Conference League, I think. I mean, it was a challenging last, you know, month or so of the season, to your point, trying to navigate which competition to focus on. But even then, I mean, I think you look at some of the league results, and Roma dropped some games to some pretty poor competition in the league that even not at full strength, you would expect them to take care of business. So, I mean, I understand that you know, the Italians did what the Italians will do when Juventus is involved, but I don't know. I think at the end of the day, they still could have salvaged some better results in the league, and, you know, just a frustrating end of the season. I don't know where you go from here, but losing Mourinho definitely is not the right direction.
Yeah, they have only won one of their last 10 games, and that was against Bayer Leverkusen in the Europa League semifinals. But if they win this weekend, they're back in their Europa League. And, I mean, I definitely agree with you. I'm not sure if Roma's going to be fishing in better waters than Jose Mourinho if they were to suddenly split. But, you know, there's reason for optimism for Roma. Certainly one of the most storied clubs, so I'm hopeful that they can kind of claw back, because today was, you know, obviously very disappointing.
Build me up, Steve. Give me some optimism.
Despite Sevilla's, you know, storied history in this competition, you woke up today feeling like Roma was going to win, right?
I don't know if I'd go that far, but I felt like they do exactly what they did. I mean, it came down to a coin flip. And I think you watched what Mourinho was able to get out of that team the last couple Europa League competitions. I don't know that we were always the better side, but we found a way to get a result. And he found a way to get them to the end of that game in a position to win it. And frankly, I think they're going to look back at that first half and say that one goal is pretty disappointing with the chances that they created.
Yeah, I thought that Roma started pretty well, but once they got that goal with Dybala, they started to pack it in. Some of their first subs were defensive, and certainly the tactics became more defensive. I would say I was probably a little bit disappointed in that. I feel like Roma's got a little bit more power in them going forward than they were given license to create. But ultimately, again, I'm hopeful just from a historic or romantic perspective that they can get back into Europa next season and try and prove their mettle there. I know that there's a pretty tough financial situation there. They're probably expected to lose Tammy Abraham, including the Mourinho departure. But, I mean, Tammy Abraham hasn't been that spectacular the last several months, so maybe they can find a solid replacement. And, you know, there's nothing too terribly embarrassing about losing to Sevilla in a Europa League final. Everyone else seems to do it. So Liverpool's done it. Inter Milan's done it. Benfica's done it. So, you know, that's pleasant company, I suppose.
It happens. It happens. Is there kind of any symmetry here between Dortmund coming agonizingly close, given the position that that club typically occupies as somebody who recruits amazing young talent, but are always ultimately selling when they have to, and Roma, who, if you just look at the murderer's row of exports that that side has in world football, if they were able to keep this trajectory going, if they were able to keep jumping through these hoops, make it up to the Champions League, I mean, I know they are facing a certain financial situation, but that extra cash wouldn't have put them in the peril that they would be in. Are you worried, Chip, that they're now going to revert back to old form and just be the selling club that can't hold on to the prized assets?
Yeah, I think, you know, that's my number one fear with today's result is I think Champions League football could have propelled us further on the trajectory that we were on, winning the Conference League last year, winning the Europa League this year, starting to get some bigger names. Signing Dybala, that's one of the biggest names that Roma has signed. Even with all those departures, I mean, he's a world-class, you know, striker. And I think, you know, now you look at it and, you know, does a guy like him leave? Does it cause Mourinho to leave? Not being in Champions League football, does it force us into, like you said, reverting to selling off some of these promising younger guys that we have? And like I joked with you about going and signing a bunch of washed up, you know, rejects from the major leagues around the world. That seems to be our history.
Yeah.
I feel like we've put enough of a black shroud on this. As our friend Carl Mueller from Succession would say, what's the positive, Gaze?
What is?
I don't know. I need you guys to tell me, because right now I am struggling for the positives. I mean, at the end of the day, I guess you could say that the quality of football that we played in Europa League is something that we can look at and hopefully attract other people to come be a part of. I think if they can somehow convince Mourinho to stay around, there's been tons of comments this year from the guys on the squad about how much of a positive influence he's been on their form and their career. And maybe that attracts some guys. But to y'all's point, there's still the financial obstacle of being able to pay for those guys to come. So I guess we'll see.
So, Chip, final question, and this is the most important question.
Okay.
You obviously want Charlie, young Charlie, to love the beautiful game in the same way that you do.
All right.
And, you know, we don't want him to be a front runner. We don't want him to be whatever, but we want him to have things to be excited about.
Maybe he does want a managerial change at Roma then.
Yeah. So how good does Roma need to be? Do they need to be in the Champions League when he's coming of age, when he's starting to play sports, for you to be able to usher him into this fandom? Or
look, I like to think I'm raising a man of character who doesn't need to latch himself to the shiniest toy in the room, you know? I think cheering for a squad like Roma builds character and builds, you know, resiliency. And so I hope that no matter where Roma is, when he comes of age, he's able to appreciate the climb. And I think that's a big part of what being a Roma fan is, because we're not the guys with the biggest budget. But I think you look at the fan base we have, and, you know, we do have some of the biggest hearts out there. So
you do have some of the big hearts out there.
There's my answer.
Just get him to Rome before he's like 14 and give him some fried artichokes and cacio e pepe, and I think you'll be job done.
And you can grandfather him in.
There we go.
Just make sure he pulls a Ralph and he like plays, like, you know, our buddy Ralph played with Alabama every year that they were on probation for like 6 years in NCAA football, just for the principal. So the second they got decent, we had to let him do it. So once Roma gets bought up by some oil-rich sheik, he's going to be like, hey, I've been here the whole time.
He'll be like a Newcastle fan.
Yeah.
We got to get Charlie one of the SPQR jerseys. That's the key.
Yeah, we will.
Yeah, one of the ones where it's not blatantly obvious that they just taped it on, though.
We'll get one from the source.
We'll get one from the source.
Shit.
Well, Chip, thanks for joining us. We're looking forward to having you back to talk about Serie A next year and everything that's coming up in the wonderful world of the beautiful game. Any special shout outs? I know that there's a lovely woman who's probably trying to keep your child asleep right now.
Yeah, you know, I want to shout out my wife for not murdering me for deciding to jump on a soccer podcast at 9:30 at night after she's been watching my child all day. But I do want to say I'm honored to be on the greatest football podcast that there ever was or ever will be.
Ever will be.
You guys put out amazing content and more people need to listen. So keep doing what y'all do, and I'll be back whenever y'all will have me.
You keep doing what you do. Godspeed.
Godspeed, gentlemen.
And we will talk to you soon.
All right, guys.
Later, Chipper. Love you.
Later, brother. When we come back in the Just for Kicks podcast, we have a special edition of EPL Superlatives and Not-So-Superlatives. Welcome to Just for Kicks podcast. You know, there are a lot of publications that have already put out their lists of Manager of the Year and the EPL and all these litany of different awards. Spoiler alert, either they're wrong or they're right, but for the wrong reasons. And we're going to explain to
you. We can all be right.
Yeah, I don't know. It's 2024. Can we live in that world?
It's 2023, so maybe not yet.
You think you got me there? Okay. I think we have to start with the immovable object. But I have a feeling, you have it in you to bluff your way to a sound counter-argument. EPL Player of the Year, it's got to be Erling Haaland, right? Or is there someone else you can make a case for?
It's hard to say it's not Erling Haaland. He has the most goals in Premier League history in one season, regardless of how many games were played. He is the leading scorer on the best team. He is the highlight reel on the best team. But I think there's a case to be made for others. Where do you stand?
You know, we always kind of view this award as somebody who was so outstanding that they made a team the best team, or, you know, took a team that otherwise wouldn't have been in contention, you know, close to contention, close to the top, or they're simply the best player on the best team. There's so many players on Arsenal that I want to point out as people who made the leap and were sort of what made them tick, namely Odegaard.
I think that's a very viable argument.
But I just, given it looks like they're going to finish the season trophyless, and Haaland was just out of control in terms of, if nothing else, the eye test. But you really start looking at the stats, you look at everything. He just so far exceeded any traditional. I mean, this campaign, he achieved more than any striker in the last 10 years and any of like the five major leagues. I mean, whew. And that's even with adjusting the physicality of the league, you know, which again, he's a big dude, not the hardest thing on the planet, but it is something that, you know, your conditioning does change as you switch leagues. But yeah, his season was so staggeringly, staggeringly insane. It's really, really hard to make a case for anyone else without sounding like a contrarian. But there are Odegaard and a handful of other people that I'm willing to listen to.
Here's where I'm going. And I think it's important to note, I'm certainly not disagreeing with you. I'm just trying to make the alternative case.
Wait, can I guess?
And I think it's really important that he...
Can I guess?
Yeah, go. Yeah, I'll let you know. I'm about to do a spiel, so if you guess it right, obviously you'll know.
Is it Rodri?
It's not Rodri.
I would accept a case for Rodri.
I don't have enough statistical output to defend Rodri, but I think that Rodri is equally as important in that team as Erling Haaland is.
Yeah.
And I think it's really important to give Haaland credit for jumping into what is considered the most physical and one of the most tactically difficult leagues. And he hit the ground running. I mean, there was one point we were talking about 60 goals in Premier League for his pace. And I also think it's important to note, he's only scored one out of his last five starts, which is part of the reason I believe he will be a worthy bet this weekend. But going back to the EPL, he scored 36 goals this season, but Man City scored fewer goals than they did last year. They had fewer points. I've said it before, I think Kevin De Bruyne is more important to that team. He, without Kevin De Bruyne, I don't know if it functions at nearly the caliber it does as if you were to instead remove Erling Haaland. In fact, up until this weekend, when they lost to Brentford, they had scored in 32 straight Kevin De Bruyne starts. The same cannot be said for Erling Haaland. And the kicker among all of this for me is Harry Kane scored 30 goals this season.
Yeah, it's just an eye-popping number.
It's completely under the radar. It ties who I think we all agree is probably the best Premier League striker by the time his career is over, barring some kind of Haaland like overtaking him. And this is the second time Kane has scored 30 goals in a season. Neither time he has won the Golden Boot. But this time, I think it's important to note, as a percentage of his team's goals, he scored 43% of Tottenham's goals this season. Haaland scored 38. In addition to the fact, his finishing statistically is better, as his non-penalty goals minus expected goals is 8.3, Haaland's is 5.9. So his finishing goes, and as a percentage point of importance for scoring for his team, I think Harry Kane has an argument for this. Tottenham was quite frankly terrible for large periods of this season.
Oh, God.
And he kept them afloat. He has had a phenomenal season and is still being an afterthought. And I don't think the gulf is nearly that wide. And in fact, I think he deserves plenty of consideration.
Yeah. That is a valid point. I mean, Heung-Min Son was just not helpful. There were a lot of times where he could have been marked out of games and he just refused to be. People always knock him for, well, always having knocks. This is one of his more durable years, and he needed to be durable or else Tottenham would have been, God, I don't know, in Chelsea's position.
And this isn't part of the criteria, but let's also consider the fact that Harry Kane had an insanely disappointing end to a very grueling World Cup, and Haaland was sitting in a spa somewhere.
Insane. And at an advanced age, and he missed the decisive kick, or what, you know, ultimately probably was. I mean, yeah, there were a lot of people that didn't bounce back from that World Cup. Harry Kane came back with a vengeance. And I think any of those guys make a strong case. Let's move along to, depending on your opinion of this whole situation, this answer is either obvious or quite, quite complicated.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it.
Manager of the year. I don't think it's Pep Guardiola yet. I think it's got to be De Zerbi. I would even venture to vote Arteta second. Maybe even Eddie Howe third. How radical is that?
Not at all. I would not disagree with that trio. I'm not sure what order I would put them in. If you held a gun to my head, who is the manager of the season? I'm probably going with Eddie Howe.
I think you have to.
And I heard someone make an argument recently for Steve Cooper keeping Nottingham Forest afloat, considering where they were at the beginning of the year with like 23 new faces or something bizarre.
At the beginning of the year, in February?
I don't think what he's done is as impressive.
Yeah.
But Newcastle had the biggest swing in point totals this season, and only a select few people expected them to make the Champions League. I think what Brighton did is probably a little bit more surprising. We'll get to that. But it's really hard to understate the importance of Newcastle securing Champions League football this season. And I don't think many people expected him to get there. It required some other teams having really disappointing campaigns, probably the same for Brighton. And there were a plethora of those. But depends on what your criteria is, basically. Who played the best football most consistently? Probably Arsenal. Who had the best team? Man City. Who was the biggest overachiever? Depends on your flavor for Newcastle versus Brighton, basically. It boils down to just what your preference for best is, I guess.
Yeah, and so much of these campaigns, though, are about seizing opportunity. And we talked about at the beginning of the year the possibility of Newcastle making the top four.
The possibility. And Man City was a favorite to win the title.
Exactly.
And we talked about that possibility, and we said, hey, we're not saying that this isn't going to happen. But if this does happen, it means that some combination of Chelsea, Tottenham, Liverpool do something very, very wrong. And Liverpool put their business shorts on a couple weeks too late. Chelsea were a disaster, unmitigated disaster. And Tottenham had an uneven season. But Newcastle, they made it count, and they did everything they needed to do before and after the World Cup to take advantage of every opportunity. Eddie Howe learned from all the great data that they collected the second half of last season and improved where they needed to improve, made shrewd signings where they needed to make shrewd signings. I know I said De Zerbi, but I'm kind of talking myself into Eddie Howe now too.
You know what? Something those three teams that had really disappointing campaigns, Spurs, Chelsea, Liverpool, all have in common is that because of their slip up and Newcastle's ascent, they will all be looking up at Newcastle, maybe for the foreseeable future, possibly henceforth, as Newcastle is now the second favorite in the opening lines to win the title next year.
Oh.
They are climbing the ladder and they are pulling it up right behind them.
Their second favorite?
They are second favorite at 850. Arsenal third, Liverpool fourth, Chelsea fifth.
Speaking of Chelsea, disappointment of the year. Chelsea going once, going twice. Do we have consensus?
I'll take Chelsea. I think there's an argument for Leicester.
Yeah.
They probably dropped further than Chelsea. They probably have worse ramifications. But yeah, Chelsea's squad, every ballooning scenario around them for their hope and, you know, purchases, we'll just be perfectly blunt, has completely fallen flat. They seem directionless and rudderless, and I'm not sure what the solution is in the immediate term. So yeah, it's got to be Chelsea.
They're a cluster of soup salad, but Leicester is just, I mean, it was just sad. It really was sad watching them capitulate down the stretch the way they did.
Yeah, Leicester's outcome is more damning, but Chelsea was more disappointing.
Yeah, that's the distinction, and that is the difference. Surprise of the year? It's got to be Arsenal. I mean, I picked them to finish third at the beginning of the year, and people looked at me like I was crazy. I think Arteta's tactical revolution, I think how they bounced back after the heartbreak against Tottenham last year that kept them out of the top four, it didn't end how a lot of people, a lot of neutrals, a lot of romantics, and obviously Gunner Nation wanted it to end, but that was my surprise of the year, and I loved every second of it.
I think it's a really good shout. If I'm going full season and outcome, I'm probably taking Fulham. I think Fulham was a candidate to get relegated, and they were hovering towards the top there for, not the top, but the European places there for a minute and survived very, very safely. But I want to consider, obviously, De Zerbi taking over for Potter and the heights he took Brighton to were a complete revelation. Newcastle making Champions League was a surprise. But mid-season appointments included, the fact that Unai Emery has taken Villa to European places from the depths that Steven Gerrard left them in is one of the most surprising turnarounds mathematically possible and certainly of this season, even though it probably shouldn't be, because Unai Emery managing teams that have Villa or Villa in their name is a match made in heaven. It's shocking.
And lastly, you want to give anybody a gold star? Anybody really, really warm your heart? Anybody really, really make you happy to be a fan of the EPL that we've not given a shout to yet?
We've been talking about De Zerbi ball a lot. Newcastle, obviously, was one of the stories of the season. I love Thomas Frank and Brentford. We haven't spent enough time on them. There's just a lot of other stuff going on around the top that we try and get to. They're one of the most resilient, smartest, interesting teams in the league. I really hope that they invest in him or that staff gets an opportunity somewhere with more investment, because what they do is genius. The only team to take 6 points off of Man City this season. They're just the most difficult team you're ever going to see. Their nickname is the Bees, and they are absolutely that irritating to everyone they play, and they are so smart in every capacity. Sucks that Tony is suspended for his gambling issues, but hopefully they'll be sticking around the Premier League for a long time to come. They've had one of the most exciting seasons.
That they have.
I just want to say something else about Thomas Frank. I think Spurs obviously should hire an ex-Chelsea coach because that's what they do. But if they were to avoid that pratfall, I think they should just admit who they are. Daniel Levy, understand that he's going to be limited in resources or limit himself in resources, and hire Thomas Frank and be like, we are going to be the most difficult top six team, and we are just going to stay afloat by being the smartest, like tactically and percentage wise.
Well, it's that time of the podcast where we give you our betting tips and you line your pockets. It's just that simple, is it not? This is our first week without league play across five major European competitions and so many more. So, from a limited slate of fixtures, Steve, what you got for us?
First bet of the weekend, Real Sociedad -140. They don't have much to play for, but they are with their home crowd in the final day of La Liga against Sevilla, who actually have nothing to play for, having qualified for Champions League with their grueling 120-minute match in Hungary Wednesday. So take the home team there, Real to Sociedad -140. Additionally, Erling Haaland, like I said, has only scored in one of his last six or seven matches. He is -130 to score in the FA Cup final. I am certain that Erik ten Hag's main objective will be to stop him from doing so, but at some point the dam is going to burst for Haaland again. Final bet, I don't know if it's available on your book. I don't have it on mine. Casemiro, yellow card, if you can get it, for anything less than -150. I don't know if it'll be in transition. I don't know if he'll be frustrated. I don't know what will happen, if there'll be a skirmish and someone draws a sword, but Casemiro will get a yellow card on Saturday.
That he will. And this is one of those rare instances that I may add where I do feel kind of comfortable laying money on City -200 to win this thing in regulation. I just don't see United being able to hang around past the 65th minute. If they even get to fourth gear, this could get ugly really, really fast. Speaking of the FA Cup getting really, really ugly really fast, what are you going to be watching this weekend, Steve?
If the FA Cup does get out of hand, you can flip over to the Women's Champions League final, 10 a.m. Saturday on Paramount Plus. That's Barcelona versus Wolfsburg for the best prize in women's soccer, but or club soccer. But alternatively, CONCACAF Champions League final, second leg, 9 o'clock Sunday. Now that succession is over, you can check into some fine footy and see if the MLS can take home its second consecutive CONCACAF Champions League final. See if LAFC, class of the league from last season, can overturn their deficit to Club Lyon.
Yeah, and that would be a staggering achievement if, after all these years of watching other teams from other countries dominate the CONCACAF Champions League, if this country can bag two in a row. But again, the marquee match of the weekend. And if it doesn't get out of hand, check out Man City against Manchester United. It's going to be on ESPN Plus at 10 a.m. Saturday. But make sure to check in, like Steve said, on that Women's Champions League final, Barca-Wolfsburg. It's going to be great. Steve, you got any fun facts that'll leave anybody's brain on the floor?
Yeah, so I've been a little disappointing in this category the last few weeks, so I came with three. The Abdoulaye Doucouré goal, the hammer for Everton to keep them up, was the 1,073rd goal of the season. That goal, in and of itself, in addition to keeping Everton up, broke the record for most goals in a Premier League season of 20 teams. So this is the highest scoring Premier League campaign we've seen.
Wow.
This is only the fourth time that all three promoted teams stayed up in their Premier League. And also, less of a fun fact, but shout out Union Berlin. We just all got kind of sad about the Bundesliga, but the happy story is that Union Berlin made the Champions League for the first time ever. So it'll be cool to see them in Europe's premier competition next season.
That is super cool. Well, thanks for listening to the Just for Kicks podcast. And whether you're listening to us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or anywhere else in the wide world of podcasting, that you're writing a review, leaving a like, subscribing, all the above. We love you guys. It's been an amazing, amazing season. And there's so much more ahead for this exciting summer. Take it easy.